Okay, so welcome everybody to new seminar of the Quantum Gravity series. This week we had the pleasure to have Simone Speziale hailing all the way from Marseille, and very thankful that he agreed to give a seminar at such a late time for him. And I don't think Simone needs much introduction. So I just let him take the stage, and he's going to tell us about latest updates on developments on the asymptotics of a spinful model. Okay, go on.
So, can you hear me?
Yeah.
I might not need introduction, but I need technical help. Since the window this meeting is being recorded appeared, I can't control my mouse anymore, and I cannot go out of full screen.
You cannot go to the screen?
So the mouse has disappeared, but I can... there, okay. Okay, I can try again to share the screen and go full screen. Working?
Yes.
Okay, great. So thank you very much for this opportunity to be back at PI in some virtual sense. I hope some of the nice atmosphere of interactions and exchanges can be still preserved. And although I know it's hard to interrupt with this way of presenting results, please try nonetheless. Stop at any time that what I'm saying is not clear, and maybe we can try to have more of a discussion. So the results I would like to present concern the asymptotic analysis of the Lorentzian EPRL model for vertices of arbitrary valence. And this is something that for the SU2BF theory and close relation to the Euclidean model was published 3 years ago, but the Lorentzian analysis took longer. It should appear pretty soon, unless tonight you manage to show me that something is deeply wrong with your questions. So before going to the technicalities, because this is going to be a bit of a technical presentation, for the sake of the students, just to give the broad picture of the interest in studying this, one of the paths that one can take to study the semi-classical limit of low quantum gravity is to consider the theory on a fixed graph. And then one can collect the degrees of freedom described by the theory on a fixed graph and try to give them some semi-classical interpretation. Because the graph is fixed, the one is only dealing with a finite number of degrees of freedom. And in a paper that we wrote many years ago with Carlo, we suggested how discrete geometries could be one interesting and useful interpretation for these finite number of degrees of freedom. The most common type of discrete geometries that are used in general relativity are the Regge geometries. But it turns out that the geometries that appear more naturally from low quantum gravity are a broader type of geometries that with Laurent we call the twisted geometries, because they have some twisting properties and also some nice relations to twisters. And to be fair, most of these was actually influenced from the spinform approach, because even prior to these developments in the understanding of the semi-classical limit of spin networks, spinform models had already suggested a possible way of interpreting the dynamics of loop quantum gravity in terms of path integrals with exponentials of the Regge action as quantum weights. So of course, on a fixed graph, this is just like a part of the story. Then one would require more than this. One would require to study the refinement, increase the number of degrees of freedom in a way that is relevant for the questions, physical questions at hand, and see what happens. But for this talk, I'm going to just be interested in the theory on a fixed graph. And the situation there is that our most favorite model, at least by most researchers at the time, is this APRL model, which was introduced by Carlo, Jonathan Engel, Roberto Pereira, and later on by Terra Levine, that joined also the collaboration, or is generalization to an arbitrary vertex, which was given by Kaminsky, Kieslowski, and Lewandowski, and also Carlo with Muxin and Uding generalized it. In the original version, this was just defined for for valent vertex, which is dual to a four simplex. And that is actually the most useful case, usually, because if one restricts to the four simplex, this provides an amplitude for four valent spin networks. And these have the simplest and most general interpretation in terms of simplicial triangulations. On the other hand, as Jurek pointed out, the Hilbert space of Lucentum gravity a priori has spin network states of any valency, not just these simplicial ones, and therefore it's nice that the model can be defined for providing amplitudes to any spin networks. And indeed, this was one of the main improvements that the model had with respect to the previous Barrett and Crane model. So it does provide a well-defined dynamics for all the states in the Hilbert space. The question is, what is this dynamics? Now, in the case of the four simplex amplitude, it was established by Barrett and collaborator that this dynamics has some interesting properties. At least in the case of a single four simplex, in the large spin limit, the dynamics is dominated by exponentials of the Regge action. Now, per se, this is not enough to say that the theory has the good semi-classical limit, and there's more work needed, and there are open questions that people keep discussing. And at three ILQGS ago, we had a nice discussions about some of these issues. Nonetheless, it is a promising result and a very interesting result. It was established for the four simplex. And you might ask the question of what happens for vertices that are not the four simplex. So that's the main question that I want to address in this talk. So to do that, let me remind you that this vertex amplitude is actually defined in the same way for any vertex graph, so for any vertex. One takes the graph dual to the vertex and then just evaluates this projected spin network, namely, one takes the group integrations of this product of matrix representations for SL2C. The representations that are used are infinite dimensionals. They are unitary of the principal series. And such representations usually are labeled by a pair of numbers, a real number rho and an integer number k. But we are instructed by the EPRL construction to freeze all the labels to be proportional to one another.
Simone, we're still on the front slide. Is that correct?
No, I changed the slide.
No, I don't see it.
I also only see the cover slide.
Oh, what happens now? What do you see now?
Now much better. Now it's appearing. But you jumped from the top one to the current one, which is number four. So we didn't see the first two.
Did you see this one?
No. now we have to rethink what you were saying.
Ah, shit.
But that's okay.
Well, okay, this is the slide that was for the benefit of the students showing the kind of general idea. And this was the brief outline that I just described. So you want to see these a little more, or can I go back to the one I was talking?
Not this one, but the next one, if you just give it a second to take a look at.
Yes, I was saying that this was the slide in which I was talking about the fact that there's this interesting property of the five valent vertex or the four simplex vertex, okay, if you want, that is related to the Regge action. And that raises the question of what about the general amplitude for an arbitrary vertex? What is that related to?
Okay, thank you, sorry.
And so maybe should I stay? Is it big enough for you if I don't go full screen? Maybe it seems that is creating problem, going full screen. If I stay like this, is it okay? Is it big enough for you?
Yeah, this is fine, Simone.
Great, thanks, Hal. So as I was mentioning, and you can see here, the vertex amplitude, the EPRL vertex amplitude is the nice feature that is defined in exactly the same way for any vertex. You just take a product of these irreducible matrices, irreducible representation matrices on each link of the graph, and then you make with these group elements here, with these arguments, and then you take integrations to ensure gauge invariance. The integration is not on all of the nodes. One node has to be removed. In the Euclidean case, that's just for redundancy. But the redundancy here will be terrible because the group integrals are infinite dimensional. and therefore one will get a non-defined amplitude if you don't remove this. In fact, even if you remove it, sometimes you get an infinite amplitude, and the question of which graphs are well-defined is a non-trivial one. But there is a criterion, which is three-length connectivity, which, although is a little bit too strict, at least it guarantees that this amplitude is well-defined for all graphs that you need to cut at least three links in order to disconnect them in two subgraphs. Yes.
If I can make a remark, maybe you come to that. Of course, one could also use just four simplex amplitude to construct amplitudes for higher graphs by subdividing. And in fact, there's papers by Benjamin Barr and Vadim Belov that show if you use the amplitudes with higher connectivity, I mean, they say it in these words, that's actually volume simplicity constraints which in this case appear and which are missing from the KKL description.
Yeah, no, that's a very good point. Let me then comment on that. So a priori, this is the definition of the model that Jurek and collaborators and also Carlo introduced, which has some very nice features, and it comes very naturally starting from the four simplex amplitude. But of course, there's one question you can immediately raise, which is the fact that the model is constructed using some discretization of the continuous simplicity constraints. And when you take this discretization, there are three types of simplicity constraints, and the model is implementing only two of them. The reason being that on the first simplex, you can show that two are enough. So if you go beyond the four simplex, your first question may be, but wait a second, maybe I want to modify the model in such a way that these third class of constraints, which are now not automatically guaranteed, are also imposed. And these we're not doing here. So that's a good point that I will come back to maybe at the end, but nonetheless, from the perspective of the definition of the model, one can investigate what happens in this case. So if you want, before, let's say that my state of mind is before modifying the model, let's see what this model actually does. You see, this is similar to the analysis we did with Barrett and Crane, that we knew there were things that might not have worked, including the fact that you couldn't apply to more general nodes than the four valent ones for spin networks. But nonetheless, we tried to use it until we saw that there was actually an effective problem with the propagator. So let's see what happens.
Okay, well, we can discuss it later, but I do think that Benjamin and Vadim, they had a reason to say that constraints are missing and that's the dynamics.
I agree, and I just explained why. The constraints that are missing are the so-called volume simplicity constraints. On the first simplex, you can prove that by imposing the diagonal and off-diagonal simplicity constraints, the flatness of the four simplex guarantees that the volume simplicity constraints are imposed. When you go beyond the four simplex, that's not true anymore. So you might wonder, well, maybe I should modify the model, which is fine, but it's not easy to understand how to modify it. And before trying...
Okay, one answer is to subdivide it into simplices.
But how do you use that now to give transition amplitudes to spin networks which are not four valent? You're going to chop the spin networks also just in four valent ones.
Yeah.
That's fine. Yeah, no, that's fine. If you want to just use only four valent spin networks, then that's fine. Absolutely. Yes. Can I go on?
Yeah.
Okay. So one way to study this... The asymptotic problem for this type of vertices is to replace these magnetic numbers with coherent state numbers. So this m is like the, or n, these are like the eigenvalues of the z component of the angular momentum, and one can replace this with a point on the sphere or a unit vector which labels an SU2 coherent state. This has a few advantages, some of them I will comment on them in the next slide. And if one does this, you can show that this amplitude decays typically in an exponential way as the spin are homogeneously increased, except if you choose some special configurations of the boundary data, which are now spins and these unit vectors, for which you get a power law. And the coefficient of this power law is the object that carries the, this interpretation in terms of the Regge action in the case of the four simplex. So when you work with the Lorentzian spinfo model, for technical reason, you end up introducing two sets of spinors. So to avoid confusion, let me explain this right from the start. One set of spinors is due to the fact that these matrices are infinite dimensional, as I was saying, and therefore they're constructed from these realizations of the Lorentz group on C2, which is like the space of a spinor. And then one spinor enters because when you try to explicitly write these matrices, you have to write them as integrals over spinors. So let me call these spinors Latin Z. On the other hand, also the SU2 coherent states, which are labeled by unit vector, is sometimes convenient from a mathematical perspective to write them in terms of spinors. And you can have this expression here in which you sandwich the Pauli matrices with a spinor, and that gives you, as an expectation value, the direction, the unit vector, whose direction is selected by the cross section between the two components of the spinor. The advantages in using the coherent states are that they introduce a finite characterization of the boundary data, but also that they permit to factorize the expression of these matrix elements, which are usually sum of many components, and you can factorize them and write this amplitude in a very nice way as the exponential of some action. These are the new integrals over the spinor Z that are necessary for the infinite dimensional representations. And these are the integrals over the group elements that are there from the start. Now, the point is that this action here, at first sight, does certainly look like anything but some discrete version of general relativity. It's linear in the spins, it's more complicated than a Reggie action, it's very unclear what it describes. So one possibility is that the relation to GR emerges in the large spin limit after you have performed the integration over the holonomies. And this is what happens for the four simplex. And this analysis, this integral over the holonomies H, over the group elements in the large spin limit, can be done using saddle point techniques, because you see this action is linear in the spins. And so you can use a saddle point approximation to evaluate those integrals. So one comment on the saddle point approximation. A priori, you would look for what we called critical points, namely points that make the gradient of the action vanish. You see the action, the integrals are over the spinor Z and the group element H. So when I talk about the gradient, I mean the gradient in H and Z. However, the action is complex. So in general, when you look at the critical value of the action, namely you evaluated at one of these critical points, you get that it might have a real part and both a real part and an imaginary part. And now, because you have this big spin J that is growing in front of the action at the critical point, you see that if the real parts are different, the values of the real parts are different between different critical points, then this will organize the critical points in different exponential weights. And so for the purposes of the finding the dominating configurations, one is interested in finding just the maximal critical points. So those for which the real part of the action is maximal. Now, in this special case of the lowest dimensional, lowest weights used by the EPRL model, the max is actually zero, which allows you to make a nice statement that says that there's only one power law and all the others are exponentially suppressed. But for instance, if you relaxed the use of minimal weights, the maximal value of the real part of the action is positive, is not zero anymore. Anyways, choosing to work just with the maximal critical point has a very strong technical advantage because it simplifies a lot the gradient equations. And so using these conditions, the gradient equations are quite simple. The gradient with respect to the group elements is just the closure constraint at each node for the boundary data. Now that's a little bit funny because in principle we are writing equations that we want to solve in terms of the integration variables, which are the spinors and the holonomies, and we are getting an equation that doesn't involve either. So this equation is just a restriction on the boundary data and shows what I was saying before. Unless the boundary data are special, there cannot be any critical point, and therefore everything is suppressed. However, imposing this closure on the boundary data is not enough. There are other equations, critical equations, which have this form. This is a spinor, and this is with other bracket here is the dual spinor obtained with the parity transformation. These are the equations that determine the group element, but these also cannot be solved in general. You need further restrictions on the boundary data. And finally, there are equations that fit the spinor at the critical point, but those are really trivial and they don't play much role in the analysis. What plays a big role in the analysis then are these equations that fix the holonomies. And let me call them boosted orientation equations for analogy with Barrett's way of calling them. So the first step to solve this type of equations is to, one way at least to solve them in a simple way, is to get rid of the spinners, which you can do without loss of generality. You can rewrite these equations as in this box, where the definition of this H is the non-unitary three-dimensional representation of little h, which was a 2x2 fundamental representation of SL2C. And the action is just defined by this sandwich here. The coherent state was defining this vector n, and therefore the coherent state with the insertion of h defines the action of capital H on n. Now, if you look at these in details, what you get is an expression like this. And now you can look up, for instance, on Wikipedia, and you will discover that this is a very well-known Lorentz transformation. It's a Lorentz transformation of a self-dual bivector, except that if this was a general self-dual bivector, n should be complex, but n is real because it's one of our real boundary data, the coherent state label. And therefore, the self-dual bivector has vanishing magnetic part, namely, it's a real self-dual bivector. Such a type of bivector, we can write it in this form, introducing a time-like preferred direction and this notation for the three-dimensional vector embedded in Minkowski space. So as a side question, why are such special bivectors popping out? After all, we started with just irreducible representations of the Lorentz group. Yeah, but not quite. Remember that we selected the lowest weights using the YMAP. And this is introducing a special role for the canonical SU2 matrix, a matrix subgroup, I'm sorry, of the Lorentz group, which is picking up this time direction. So that's where this class of bivectors is coming out from. Okay, so these boosted orientation equations actually have a very obvious solution that you can find just by looking at them. Consider a configuration in which the boundary data are pairwise opposite, namely for each A and B nodes in the graph, the vector associated with the starting vertex of that link, call it A, is opposite to the vector associated with the target node of that link, call it B, then you see that trivially taking all the group elements to be the identity solves the equations. So that's actually already right there for you, a full solution of the critical point equations. And slightly more generally, if the boundary normals are such that this pairwise opposite configuration can be achieved with arbitrary rotations node by node, so these RA are independent rotations node by node, then the critical point equations are also immediately solved by just taking those rotations as critical elements. So that's super easy. And the really interesting question is to find other solutions except from this one, or whether there are solutions in which H are not just rotations, but include actually boosts. And this is what is hard. Now, Barrett called the boundary data that satisfy this condition vector geometries. And this is actually a good time to pause in the discussion of the asymptotics and just take a detour on the geometry of the boundary data, which is quite interesting per se. So let me forget about the EPRL model for a second, and let's just think about the boundary data which go into the definition of the amplitude. These, at the most generic level, once we use these coherent state labels, we have a triple per link, which is given by the spin and these two pairs of vectors. Now, this you can recognize also as a subset of the twisted geometry parametrization of T star of SU2. A subset because the twisted geometries would also have an additional twist angle, which describes some of the degrees of freedom of the holonomy. That's not needed here because the spins, the physical reason is that the spins are taken to be sharp and only the directions are taken in a superposition. But if we were to use linear superposition of spins as well, like we did, for instance, in the graviton propagator calculations, then one would use a full coherent states in the boundary, and then that will depend also on this additional twist angle. So these are the generic data, which, as I already anticipated, don't admit any critical behavior, and therefore, for generic data, the amplitude would decay exponentially. Then, an interesting subclass of this data is to impose the closure constraints. If you do that, you get this interpretation in terms of twisted geometries, which is a collection of polyhedra with mismatches at the faces. Now, where does the vector geometry sit? It sits as a subset of the twisted geometries that satisfy these orientation conditions, as Barrett called them. Now, you'll notice that these orientation conditions are given in are orientation dependent. So one question that we investigated with Pietro was whether one could give a fully gauge invariant description of vector geometries. And in the previous paper on the SU2 asymptotics, we almost succeeded, but not quite. So for us, this remains an open question, whether vector geometries can be characterized completely in a gauge invariant way as this some subset of these twisted geometries in which some shape matching conditions are partially imposed, but not all of them. Now, speaking of partial shape matching conditions, there is one class of partial shape matching geometries which is particularly interesting, and this is the class in which you start from a twisted geometry and you impose that every face as this correct as a fixed valence, so not just a fixed area, also a fixed valence, and the angles are the same. So the angles are the same when seen from one polyhedron or the next. So these are twisted geometries for which the shapes are almost completely matched. There's only the possibility to make conformal transformations that preserve the areas, because the areas are fixed once and for all at these faces. And so you still get possible mismatches like this one. But much of the geometry is fixed. And in particular,
well, I assume in the number of the sides, right? Here,
it includes also the fixing the angle matching conditions imposes also the valence of the face, namely whether it's if it's a pentagon or tetragon. Yeah. Absolutely, yes. I'm going to say a bit more about this in the next slide. A subset of them are the three-dimensional geometries, namely those for which the full shape matching conditions are satisfied. Now, if we're talking about a triangulation, this would be a collection of tetrahedra, but we can think of regge geometries in more general sense as a collection of polyhedra with all the edges uniquely identified. Now, among the 3D regge geometries, there will be those that you can flatly embed. And these are the ones that you can think of them as the boundary of a flat polytope. Now, in the case of the four simplex, you don't care about this distinction because every 3D regge geometry of five tetrahedra glued together is flat embeddable. Or in other words, every collection of edge lengths of these five tetrahedra defines four simplex. But in general, this is not the case. So you might have 3D regge geometries which are not the boundary of 4D polytopes. So there's a lot of interesting geometry that goes on beyond the four simplex, even though, of course, I have to yield to Bianca's question and say that a priori one could forget about all of these and just deal with the four valence spin networks and the four simplex
amplitude. Simona, I have a question about the four simplex.
Yes.
If I take 10 vectors, 3D vectors, which satisfy closure.
Yes.
And I mod out the... global rotations.
Global rotations or individual rotations at every node?
Global rotations.
So not individual rotations at every node.
Yeah.
Okay.
And I assume that all the rotations, the rotation matrices are all one. I do get 15 degrees of freedom.
Okay.
So 15 is neither 10, like a regge simplex. No, it's 20, which is like tetrahedra glued together with these things.
By memory, 15 should be the vector geometries.
Yeah, so that's
up to rotations, of course.
Yeah, I modded out these global rotations.
Okay, then it should be vector geometries that you're describing.
And the rotation you have here, anyway, it's a gauge fixing.
Yes.
But the vector geometries, I mean, it doesn't seem you can interpret them as simplex geometry.
Ah, no, of course they're not. No, they're not.
So you don't interpret them as
well. That's a bit. One just make me one caveat. In principle, of course, you don't think about the vector geometries as simplices. Let me explain you why, because you see that the condition of the vector geometries is just a restriction on the vectors, on the unit vectors. So you don't talk about the spins.
Yeah, they're all in 3D.
Yeah, they're all in 3D. And they don't talk about the spins. So imagine now that I give you 10 spins that describe a four simplex, a well-defined Reggie four simplex. Okay, for instance, all the spins equal. Okay?
Yeah.
Then these 10 spins give you a four simplex, but they give you also infinitely many vector geometries, because for the same set of spins, I can give you vectors now, unit vectors that satisfy this condition.
Yeah,
so if you want, the Regge conditions are selecting those unique ends which are compatible with the geometry induced by the spins. If the vectors are not compatible, then you can get just a vector geometry. So if you want, given the spins, you have a five-dimensional space that satisfies these conditions, and there's one point that will also match the Regge geometry defined by the spins.
Yeah, I think part of my question, if you have an understanding of what are these 5 degrees of freedom?
Well, let's discuss
in geometrical terms, gauge invariant terms.
You know. No. As I mentioned, with Pietro, we managed to get a description of out of these five, we had a gauge invariant description for four. So four of these five, you can describe them as shapes. You know, like when with Halle, you discuss about the space of shapes of these tetrahedra. So four of the variables are one shape parameter per tetrahedron. Uh-huh. But the fifth variable cannot be one shape variable for the fifth tetrahedron, unfortunately. It's some ugly angle between opposite faces, which is not a gauge invariant quantity. So we did not quite succeed to completely answer this question. We don't know if one can do better. We would be very interested in knowing.
I think you need more global... I mean, you can probably not specify per tetrahedron, but you need to put the entire simplex... Consider the entire simplex, kind of. Okay, sorry.
No, it's okay. It's fun to discuss these things. I don't know if...
I just said I talked about it because I tried to think of a PM.
That's right. But Bianca, you know, I think maybe there's just five people in the world that might be counting these things, you know?
It's an easy counting.
Okay.
They're surprised because everyone thought it's actually 10.
Okay, see. Well, we'll discuss this more later. Okay, so this was just a slide to show you that there's this rich kinematical interpretation of this boundary data, which is very general. It applies just to loop quantum gravity, and it would apply to the boundary data of any... Yes?
Hello? Yeah. So first, I want to know your altitude. So for those vector geometries, you like those vector geometries or you don't like those vector geometries? because you know, this vector geometry can be easily ruled out by using time like tetrahedra, time like services.
You can also rule out, you don't need to go so sophisticated. You can require that the spins select Lorentzian for simplices, and then you also rule them out. You don't need any sophistication. By the way, speaking of the time like tetrahedra, so the attitude I have, it's open-minded. Maybe at the end we'll discuss it more, but let's say open-minded for the time being. They slightly worry me, but I don't know if they are, I don't have proves, you see, that they are the source of possible strong problems with the model. So I'm quite open-minded.
Okay.
So these conformal twisted geometries, which satisfy the angle matching, why would we need to introduce them? Well, they have they appear naturally in the analysis, you will see in a few minutes, but they have some nice geometric properties. The fact is that if you have a well-defined valence for each dual phase, for each phase dual to the link, then you can also have a map from the cycles of the graph to the edges of a cellular decomposition. So that's one thing. But the most important thing is that they allow you to assign a unique 4D dihedral angle to each phase. So that's important. You don't need Regge geometries to have just one well-defined unique dihedral angle. So how does that work? So for any set of data, you can take scalar products between the normals at the same node, CA. So this would be the normal starting from the normal at the polyhedron A, the face shared with the polyhedron B, and then the same polyhedron A, the face shared with polyhedron C. So these are two normals in the same polyhedron. Take the scalar product that defines you a 3D dihedral angle for that polyhedron. And now you can use standard spherical cosine laws, which are just, they don't even need the existence of polyhedra. They're just intersection of hyperplanes. So these spherical cosine laws, here I'm choosing three nodes called 1A and B. They will be defined like this. And they will define some 4D dihedral angle now. The only problem is that this 4D dihedral angle, as I just said, is the intersection of three hyperplanes. So it depends on these three labels. Well, let's live with that for the time being. One interesting thing to point out is that this data here, this right-hand side, is using only the normals, no spins. And yet, this can already tell you if your configuration is Lorentzian or Euclidean, simply because you compute this quantity here and you check. If it's in between minus 1 and 1, you call this configuration Euclidean. If it's bigger or smaller than 1, you call it Lorentzian, thick wedge, or thin wedge. Unfortunately, I can never, ever get which one is thick and which one is thin. So with Pietro, we decided to rename them co-cronal when the two normals point in the same direction and anti-cronal when they point in opposite direction. I don't like renaming things.
So much better as a name.
I'm sorry about that because I really don't like renaming things, especially since it's been used for 20 years, but it's just so hard to remember which one is thick and thin. So anyways, that's the first interesting thing, that you can characterize the data as Lorentzian or Euclidean by just looking at the normals. But then, if the 2D angles match, and that's all you need, then this expression becomes independent of B and defines a unique 4D angle for the face shared between the polyhedron 1 and the polyhedron A. Now, Bianca might remember that with Jimmy, she defined the shape matching conditions instead of as angle matching, as edge matching. And you can do the same here. You can impose the not just the 2D angle matching, but just the angle between the edges matching is the same thing, of course. And that condition will also be enough to have a unique expression here without the need to impose also that the length of the edges is well defined. So this geometry is special for this reason. Now here I'm actually looking at a simple case, which is the one in which the spherical cosine laws are built out of three cycles, which for the first simplex is all you need. Now when you move to bigger polytopes, there's plenty of things that are more complicated or more interesting if you want. One of them is that there are edges which are not dual to three cycles, but they're dual to bigger cycles, like four cycles or five cycles. In this example, it's a four cycle. I'm not going to go into the details. I just want to say that you can define generalized spherical cosine laws in any of these cases. The expressions are actually the more and more complicated, but you can write them. They look simply like this, except that this is not this angle that appear here now is not really a 3D dihedral angle. But again, for angle matching data, that's enough to have such a definition to be edge independent, and therefore there's a unique 4D angle. So that's the cool thing about these angle matched twisted geometries. Now let me go back to the asymptotics after this dissertation on these boundary geometries. And let me show you the new way of solving it that we are proposing. I mean, we're not proposing it because we are unhappy with Barrett's way. It's just that Barrett's way, there's no way it would apply to anything that is not the four simplex. I also have doubts that it would apply to other more complicated models for each in which you don't select the lowest weight. So because we wanted to generalize it, we had to find another way. And it turned out that this other way that we chose has some interesting features. It is simpler in a sense than Barrett's way, and it's very geometrical. So let me briefly show it to you how it works. So these are the equations we want to solve. And we can use the fact that there's one less vertex integration, because else the whole amplitude is just infinite. So let me call one the vertex in which there's no holonomy, there's no group element. And let me look first at those equations in which A is equal to 1. And let me rename B equal A, hoping not to confuse you with that. So that's the first set of equations I'm going to look at, and these are the blue equations with respect to this picture. Now, let me use the gauge freedom of rotating independently the normals at each node. This gauge freedom changes the global phase of the amplitude, but not the norm of the amplitude. So that's why we're calling it gauge freedom, because it doesn't change the norm of the amplitude. To obtain an alignment between all the normals in these four tetrahedra, which are shared with the initial tetrahedra. If we do this, you'll see that here I can replace minus Na1 with N1A. And now look at the equation from here to here. It's a super simple equation. It's just telling you that capital H is stabilizing this 3D vector. And what is that? Well, that's because capital H is an SL2C element. That would be an SL2C element whose direction must be aligned with Na1 or 1A. Anyway, they're just opposite to one another. And this free parameter, which I cannot determine, is some complex parameter. One, the real part would be a rotation, and the imaginary part would be a boost. And in this way, we have already determined all the directions thanks to choosing a gauge freedom. Thanks to choosing a special gauge, we have already determined all the directions of the group elements. We just have to determine now these angles, complex angles, omega. To do that, we have the red equations, namely those six equations that are between all the other tetrahedra. Well, how do we do that? First, we rewrite those equations like this. So I've just multiplied everything by capital H minus one. Now, in the theory of Lorentz transformations, this type of Lorentz transformation is called a force screw. And if you're multiplying two of them, you can either read the result on Wikipedia and do it by yourself using properties of the Pauli matrices. The result is some longish expression that involves scalar and vector products of the vectors. It's not particularly enlightening until you take scalar projections using the vectors you have at disposal, and then you can show that the two independent equations of this vectorial equation of unit norm can be, can be written in this beautiful way. So cosine of omega plus some angle, which I'm going to define in a second, equal to some other cosine, and same for the sines. So you see, it's just everything is trivial, simple trigonometry. And what are these angles that have appeared? Well, this theta hat is precisely the spherical cosine law I defined before. So you see, it appears by itself, just from the critical point equations. And the second angle, now Bianca is going to be happy, is the, well, maybe not completely happy, because it's not a gauge invariant twist angle in the sense that there's no holonomy that is giving you the parallel transport. So this is just the scalar product between the edge vectors in each in their own frame. This is the other quantity that is appearing here. And so you already see immediately that you will need angle matching conditions to solve these equations, because in general, you want to solve for omega A, but you have quantities that will depend on B. So a priori, only if these things don't depend on B, you will find solutions. So let's see what happens in slightly more details. This is a cosine equation, so that's an even function. So in general, it will give you two solutions, omega equal plus or minus theta hat minus psi bar. And the second equation involves omegas at different nodes, and therefore it will give you a constraint between the omegas among themselves. Now we separate omega into real and imaginary part, and we can look for Euclidean solutions in which beta is zero, or Lorentzian solutions in which beta is non-zero. As I said, it's just trivial trigonometry, you find the solutions. Well, not really trivial. I mean, the solution would be just plus or minus theta minus psi bar. And as I said, in general, for this to be a solution, you need that these quantities are independent of B, so you need the shape matching or just angle matching conditions, really. However, the little magic is that the plus sign, you can prove that does not require any angle matching condition. And that is the one solution that corresponds to the vector geometries. So let me just take it for granted. Let me not go into the details now. So that would be the vector geometry solution that we know anyway always exists if the data satisfy the vector geometry conditions. And the shape matching conditions are a subsector of them. And then there's the Lorentzian sector. Now, if you know Barrett paper, it takes pages and pages to find the solution. And then it takes another, I don't remember, two or three pages just to fix that there's one global angle freedom. Here is just very simple. A priori, every individual omega has assigned freedom. And then is this other equation that you can show that it's only solved if there's a unique angle, it's a unique sign freedom. So to me already, this was a very nice improvement. So let me make now some side comments. So this is just to show that we have recovered the classification of Barrett for the asymptotics of the four simplex. And then similar calculations that just use trigonometry can be used to compute the action and reproduce the complete formula at the critical point. But maybe you might not like all these angles. So I remember that when Bianca had her talk a few weeks ago, Lee was saying, wait a second, we started with this nice and elegant representation of holonomies and fluxes that we have in loop quantum gravity. Why have we been talking now for 40 minutes about all this pile of dihedral angles and complicated things? Why is that happening? I think that's a very nice question. And we already discussed it a bit during Bianca's talk. I wanted to give a couple of more thoughts about it. One thing is that, of course, there's always the mixing between first order and second order formalism, because the holonomies and fluxes are so elegant and simple because they really are like a first order formalism. But if you look back at GR, in the first order formalism, everything effectively looks so nice and elegant and beautiful. It's just polynomial equations. All the complications are hidden in the solutions of this equation here, which will introduce all the nonlinearities and the non-polynomiality of the field equations. So holonomies and fluxes per se are very simple, but once you start having to implement the fact that part of the holonomy is the Levi-Civita holonomy, they will be necessarily somehow less elegant, because there will be the need for them to know about nonlinearities of the metric. Then there's also the problem of the truncations. And because all I've described today is in this framework in which we keep a fixed lattice or a fixed graph, if you want, and we try to describe the dynamics in that sense, having the anchor of discrete geometries helps a lot trying to give an interpretation to the dynamics, which is otherwise hard to give. And unfortunately, this interpretation in terms of discrete dynamics comes with all these technical details and this pile of dihedral angles, if you want. So maybe one can do better. It would be very interesting if one can do better, more elegant things. We heard Daniele, our tonight's host, spinning the ILQG into a new type of continuous interpretation of the spin network degrees of freedom as boundary charges. And maybe that could be the way forward. I don't know. I'm just pointing out that even though these technicalities are hard, they do offer a clear view into what is the dynamics on a fixed graph. So this technique that I've just introduced, let me stress once again that I've never invoked the bivector reconstruction theorem. I've never used any algebraic map between bivectors and algebra elements of SL2C. I've never had to prove the commutativity of any diagrams. I just did elementary trigonometry and solved the whole system with all the details that are also in Barrett's paper. The price to pay for this, nothing comes for free, is that everything is gauge dependent. And now you might say, well, then when things are gauge dependent, usually they're horribly gauge dependent. That might be the case. But it's not so much the case here, because if you accept to live in this world of discrete geometries, then there's a very nice and obvious gauge that is better than any other, which is the gauge in which the edges are aligned. If the shapes match, then you can align all of them. If they don't, you can align only one of them. But still, you can always require to do this. And that's the gauge that we have been using to some extent in solving this system. The benefit, on the other hand, is that you can now apply this algorithm to this technique to any graph, which you couldn't do if you needed to invoke the bivector reconstruction theorem, which only applies to the four simplex. And how does it work? It's an iterative algorithm in which you start from a node called 1, where we assume there's no integration. And there you solve the critical equations for all the first neighbors to it. Then you choose one of the first neighbors, let me call it a bar, and you iterate the procedure. You look at all the first neighbors to a bar. Some of them you've already determined, like b bar here. Some others you have not. And now you use the equations of motion, the critical equations in a similar way. The one connecting a bar to this node will give you the direction. And then you will use the ones among these nodes, for instance, to fix the complex angles omega. And again, you will get these global constraints also that will fix the relative signs to match. So technically, what you need to do at the end of the day is to choose what is called a dominant node set of the graph, namely a set of nodes such that every other node is first neighbors to them. And that's the choice you have to make. And then you run the algorithm. And there are more clever choices, of course, that one can make, but that's not so important. The important thing is that in principle, this you can apply to everything. You can apply to everything, and you can, even though, of course, there can be always some very special graphs that have some funny properties and something strange happens, you can actually, we have investigated various examples, which I'm going to list shortly, but you can still draw some general conclusions from the specific investigations with in the paper we provide the algorithm in all generality. So as I already anticipated in the way I derived the first simplex analysis, the true conditions for the existence of the distinct critical points, so not just the vector geometries, but more than that, are angle matching conditions. The fact that for the first simplex they imply regular data is a consequence of the fact that all the faces are triangular there. But if you have a more general graph, this will not be the case. And therefore, you get something more general than regular geometries at the critical point. This is actually nothing new. This was observed for the first time by Sebastian and Benjamin when they were looking at some regular hypercubical lattice in their renormalization approach. They discovered the existence of these non-regular points. They call them non-geometric. I would like not to insist on that because they are just some special type of twisted geometries. In fact, they're actually nice twist geometries with this angle matching condition. So in some sense, they are very geometrical. It's just that they're not completely piecewise linear like regular geometries. The 3D regular geometries do exist. They are subsets with the same number of critical points. And there's a further subset, which are those 3D regular geometries that can be embedded as boundaries of flat polytopes, and therefore you can also use immediately to define 4D regular geometries. For the others, the 3D regular geometries that you cannot flat embed, one has to think about what to do with them. One idea would be that you can embed them as the boundaries of curved for polytopes, but that's not clear to me how to do that. Another new feature that appears is that you can have more than two critical points. Now, that's kind of obvious because you can think of just reducible graphs. For instance, Hall, when he studied the asymptotics of the 9J symbol, he obviously chose to work with the reducible 9J symbol because if you take the reducible one, you can write it as the product of two 6Js, and then the asymptotic is just the product of two, which is the product of two cosines, and therefore you have four distinct critical points. Now, what's also true and is not so obvious, and this is what also Benjamin saw for the first time, is that also for irreducible graphs, you can find multiple critical points. And in fact, we showed with Pieter in the paper that is about to appear that this is a characteristic of modular graphs, in which what happens is that these global constraints that fix all the angles epsilon are not enough to completely fix a global sign freedom, and therefore you are left with individual sign freedoms in subgraphs. And then there's this beautiful interplay between the spherical cosine laws and the critical point equations. Not only for the first simplex, as I already showed you, these spherical cosine laws appear automatically, also for the more complicated case of n cycles, not just three cycles, in which the spherical cosine laws are complicated, they appear naturally from the critical point equations. So naturally, in fact, that you can actually learn about the ways these spherical cosine laws work, these generalized ones, just by looking, ignoring all the geometry, just by looking at these critical point equations. So this is the phase diagram of the boundary data, zero critical point for generic data, and then one or more than one for all these subclasses. It's just a qualitative diagram, but it gives you the idea. And so now for the actual result, what are the general asymptotic formulas? Here they are in all their glory. As I said, there's always one critical point for vector geometries, and that's the formula you get, which is just an application of the standard point for stationary phase approximation. And now here there's the second interesting property that these angle matching geometries have. So not only they arise at the critical point equations, but also because the 4D dihedral angles are uniquely defined, namely there's just one 4D dihedral angle per face, you can write something that looks like the Reggie action, and it's unique and well-defined. Of course, it's not the Reggie action, because as Bianca and myself would tell you, you will need to add closure and shape matching to get the Reggie action. Now, you might argue that closure is somehow imposed because it's part of the critical point equations. But of course, this brings us back to the discussion we already had on the LQGS, which is that it is true that it's imposed, but it's not imposed as a delta. It's imposed as some type of exponential falloff, so some types of Gaussian. So this goes in the direction of the models that Hall and Bianca are investigating with the shape matching imposed as Gaussians. But anyway, for my mathematical result, the fact that this object is well-defined for all the angle-matched conformal twisted geometries is important in writing the asymptotic formula, which has this nice expression, very similar to the four simplex one. This psi is the global phase that depends on the orientation, but also on phase conventions. And if the graph is non-modular, you have only two critical points. And it's the same story that with the four simplex. For the Euclidean data, you just get this generalized Reggie action. For the Lorentzian data, you get gamma in front of it, and this additional factor here. On n-modular graphs, you have up to 2n critical points, so you will write it in a more complicated way like this. Now, in writing these formulas, I have assumed that the Hessian determinant is non-zero. This was not proved by Barrett. In the paper in which we published the asymptotic numerics of the four simplex, we computed explicitly the Hessian determinant, and we showed numerically that it was invertible, non-degenerate, sorry, for all the configurations we used. Then Wojtek and Hanno proved it analytically. One other thing that we showed was that is at the two critical points for the four simplex, it's actually the complex conjugate to itself, and therefore you can really write the four simplex asymptotic as a cosine, like the 6J. But for general graphs, we don't know, we haven't attempted to evaluate it, so I'm just writing it in this form here. One thing you can learn from this, but it's kind of trivial to learn, is that among the Reggie configurations, the four simplex is the dominant one, because it's the one that has the lesser number of nodes among those graphs that have a 4D Reggie-like interpretation possible. But this is kind of obvious from the structure of the group integrals. So this is the graph that is modular, and this is actually the graph that Benjamin was studying, in which he showed that there are these multiple solutions. And in fact, we studied individually all these various graphs that you can see here, because they exemplify different features that can happen. We consider this complete graph with six vertices, in which you can see the conformal twisted geometries for the first time, because the faces here are not triangles anymore. We consider the hypercube, which is the first case in which you have a second neighbor. Well, the first case, which is a case in which you have a second neighbor. We also consider the simpler graph with a second neighbor, because Carlo needs it for some of his calculations. And this is also interesting because it's an example of a graph that has no 4D polytope interpretation, at least no 4D polytope that I know of, but still has critical points for vector geometries and angle-matched twisted geometries. And finally, we consider the Santa Claus graph. Don't blame me for that. Benjamin decided to call it like this. I don't know if Sebastian had any influence in that. Anyway, this is a nice example because not only it's modular. Modular means that you can isolate two subgraphs by cutting links, or let me say it better. There are nodes that are connected. There are two subgraphs that you can see are connected among each other with nodes that are like each node that links to another subgraph only links to one node of the subgraph. In the paper, we describe it better. Now I'm too tired to remember. But it's also an example of situations in which you cannot use the basic spherical cosine laws, because there are edges like 2,8 in which all cycles that this edge belongs to, this link belongs to, are 4 cycles. And so you have to use these generalized spherical cosine laws, which also complicates a bit the analysis, but works out fine. Okay, so to summarize the results, the asymptotic analysis of the Hyperl model is possible for any vertex graph. The four simplex is the one with the slowest power law decay among all those that have a 4D Regge interpretation. But in general, you can have this more general action appearing. Now, what are the physical implications? Now, to come back to Bianca's initial question and also a little bit of Muxin's question. So my attitude tonight was just to present you these mathematical results and answer a well-defined question, which is, what is the asymptotic of this model? Now, one can go beyond that and try to say, okay, what does this teach us now? Now, this punchline, Bianca already burned it, because she has already anticipated the fact that we might have expected to see something more general than Regge geometries anyways, because of lacking these volume simplicity constraints. Fair enough. And in fact, modifications of the model have been explored by Benjamin and Vadim Belov. I have no idea what is the asymptotic. So I don't know what it changes to the description I've already gave you. Now, the question of removing some critical point, some critical data, or if you want some boundary data from the critical behavior, actually resonates with other ideas to restrict the four simplex amplitude, like taking the proper vertex as Jonathan and Antonio, or apart from the time-like mentioned before, also introducing the Gaussian like he does in some of these papers. Bianca with Hall and Seta Sante, they are also investigating this Gaussian imposition of the shape matching. So all of these modifications of the model are fine, they're interesting for their own reason. As I said a few weeks ago, I'm a skeptic of many of the flatness arguments that have been put forward for the APRL model. So as of today, I still don't pressure to go beyond the APRL model. But anyway, it is true that these are certainly interesting open questions for future work. For today's work, my main message is that I asked myself this question, what is the asymptotic now of this general vertex, shortly after it appeared. And it was clear that it was not an easy question because the techniques available were not good to answer it. And now we do have techniques that answer this question. And I think that's good and interesting beyond a discussion of the modifications and physical applications, because maybe they can be applied to other problems that you have in mind. And that's just a note. And if there are further questions.
Sorry, the audio was a bit. Are you finished with the presentation this morning?
Yes.
Okay.
Finish the last slide, the volume.
Yes. Let's thank Simone first and then we go on with the questions, okay?
All right. People are confused because people see that there is another slide after that. So people were expecting the last slide.
I know, it's just an old slide which I didn't erase. Sorry. There. It's the same as this summary of results. I just changed it a little bit and didn't erase.
All right. So Bianca has a question, I see.
Thanks for the nice talk. It's again to emphasize, because you say modify the model, but in principle, even for with a simplex amplitude, you can use it for the entire LKG Hilbert space and for each spin network graph.
Which are you talking about? Which amplitude are you talking about?
I mean, the EPL, FK, whatever, of course, better train you cannot take, but you can apply it to every spin network state by just expanding the because we do quantum mechanics, expanding it into four valent ones.
Sure, of course you can.
I mean, but then, like, there's uniqueness, of course, but then you just need the simplex amplitude.
I agree, but then why don't you also further expand and everything, make it three valent? I mean, there's a reason why we stop at four valent, because we like to think.
We don't make it three valent for the reason that we want to have something non-degenerate.
Well, let me.
That is another reply to Lee's concern that working with only holonomies that was very elegant, but also for some time had all zero volume.
Let me interject.
But do you believe if you have a node with 1,000 links, you just need to use the KKL description? I mean, I was skeptical to the KKL description from the beginning, because it means we don't need to basically do any bulk integration.
So the...
You are not hearable.
The audio is a bit bad, Simone.
Simone, we can't hear you.
You fall asleep?
I think we just can't hear him.
Simone, he lost connection probably, right?
Sess is still in the meeting, but we can try to.
It's. I think it's really losing the connection.
We restart.
With the chat.
Hello.
I can.
Hello.
Yeah.
Can you hear me?
Yeah. Now we can hear you.
We can hear.
Oh, okay. Sorry. So very good. I think Bianca, you were asking many questions at once. Let me try to prepare. So from the point of view of reducing the valency of the spin networks, of course you can do that. The way you stop at four and you don't go all the way to three, as you pointed out, is that then if you use the physical interpretation of the volume operator as a volume, you would get the general degenerate geometries. But that's the key point. The physical interpretation is playing a role here. If I want to use five valent nodes and give them a physical interpretations, then I need a model that can propagate those without having to chop them into four valent vertices. So if we decide that we can give different physical interpretation to four valent and five valent spin networks, then we do need a model that can do that. Now, a situation, for instance, in which this can happen is, you know, when you count the entropy of black holes by just looking at all the shapes that a polyhedron can have. For instance, Eugenio was trying to count it like this. So this viewpoint is relevant for that type of approach. It still does not mean that coarse grain your block spin foam to having just one vertex, because that would be just the first amplitude that contributes to the physics of your boundary spin network. To project it on the physical space, you will have to sum over all the bulk spin foams, and that will introduce dynamics, of course. So I don't see, even though I'm happy we're restricting to just four valent spin networks, if you don't do that, and maybe you have physical reasons not to do that, I don't see that forces you to having only these giant vertices and not also sum over internal faces, which will introduce dynamics of the spin foam level. Could you hear that? Or I was talking to myself?
Yeah,
good.
I could hear that. Yeah, I think we kind of have different opinions on the different levels, but
okay.
Let me stop here with it. Let me stop here with the discussion. I mean, it's really that this, if you take the giant nodes,
Well, okay, but let's not take a giant node.
Would you stick with this description? Yeah.
Let's not take a giant node. Let's just stop at the Hypercube one. The Hypercube can be useful for many things. You and myself argued together with Laurent that the Hypercube allows to make a better connection with the graviton propagator. Sebastian and Benjamin have been arguing that the Hypercube is good for renormalization studies. So, okay, maybe we can do better than the APRL KKN model, but for the time being, that's what we have. So what is the general asymptotics of an hypercube of the EPRL model? This was not known. Sebastian and Benjamin had found some simple cases. Now we know it in full generality. And the fact that we can answer this type of questions, I think it's good.
Yeah, sure, and I agree, but also, if you, I mean, we did subdivide the hypercube, if you remember.
Yes.
And then, you know, okay, we did do it in 3D, but in 4D, I mean, Azar showed that they do get a correct number of propagating degrees of freedom, and if you have also the conformal twisted contributions, which are very interesting, but these will be additional degrees of freedom.
For sure. For sure.
And I don't understand, because nobody came up with a proposal, what is the dynamics of these degrees?
No, I think this is...
What do they do in the asymptotics? So that's...
Mm-hmm. I think this is a very good question. And
that is a question, yeah. I asked since twisted geometries or before the paper switched to me, what happens with these degrees of freedom?
I know we were recently complaining with Laurent that we never answered this question of defining curvature for the twisted degrees of freedom. And I think it's something that one should go back to. Carlo, Wolfgang, and Hall, and Francesca had started thinking in those directions. And I think it would be useful to go forward and see what can be the interpretation and the curvature definition and an action principle for these additional components. Now, as you can see, some of them, these angle-matched ones, are already suggesting a way forward because the 4D dihedral angle is well-defined, at least. If you go even beyond that, then you have these edge-dependent dihedral angles that you work with.
Well, yeah, which we had in the beginning, yeah.
Yes,
but I do think these are torsion degrees of freedom, and we got more. And actually, I think the paper by Hall and friends does exactly show that.
I think they're all connected here, so ask them.
It's one part of this of the transformation thing, and we got also recent confirmation in our analysis of this 2-gauge model. But in any case, I do think it's torsion degrees of freedom, if that helps for anything.
Simone?
Hello?
Hello. Very nice talk about this extension. I have a question.
Thank you.
Which goes a little bit outside of the scope of what you're talking, but in fact it relates to just what you were discussing, Bianca. Which has to do with, because you have these twisted geometries that appear there. And I think, you know, there is an understanding now that is coming, clear into what these twisted geometries are. And I was wondering whether, you could see that in the study of the asymptotic. So what I'm referring to is the paper that was mentioned, the paper by Al, Wolfgang, and Carlo, you know, about the fact that there's an SL2R in twisted geometry. You can rectify the twisted geometry by an SL2R transformation. And then there's this paper, quantum gravity at the corner with Alessandro, where we show that, in fact, if you study the boundary geometry, there's a SL2R generator, which is a tangential metric. And this guy is part of the boundary symmetry. And then with Etera, we understood how this, we call them bubble geometry, but this is essentially twisted geometry with the fact that you keep track of the SL2R generator, which means that, in fact, when you glue the geometry If you want to construct a continuum geometry, in fact, you should not take the Redger matching. You should have this SL2R, holonomy that glue them together. And it becomes even clearer with the work with Daniele and Mark that, you know, in the continuum, these SL2R holonomy are like the gravity, you know, they are like the compression waves of the graviton, if you want. So what it looks like, and, you know, in the context of EPR, so I was wondering, because you're working in the context of EPRL, and here I'm talking about a much more refined understanding, which is now, you know, clearly settling down and crystallizing very clearly, that there's this additional tangential degrees of freedom, which were foreseen by Wolfgang and Alan Carlo, but now we live in the continuum. So whether this tangential metric degrees of freedom, you know, do you see them in your analysis? So would you have to add them up, or, you know, because you have to see geometry, they must be there, but somewhere, I know that in your analysis, in your psyche, you are not looking for them, but thinking back now that we understand what's going on, can you, with your detailed knowledge of this tangential geometry, can you see that in fact there is extra degrees of freedom, which are the tangential metric, right? The diffeomorphism.
Yeah, I can see a way in which, yes, I can see a way in which one can try to start looking at those type of degrees of freedom, because this analysis for the first simplex or the generalized one that I've done treats all these twisted geometries as fixed boundary data. And then what one does is that it trivially glues the vertex amplitudes by just assuming that you have the same twisted geometry data on the one hand and the other hand of the edge, and then integrating over them trivially. So it's like a rigid gluing. But now you could imagine that, so this is how I can see your type of discussion entering the game here, because one, maybe this kind of rigid gluing is wrong. Maybe this is what leads to problems. I don't know. But I can see that one could try to seek for more general gluing of this data now. Mm-hmm. For instance, paper mismatching, this SL2C generator is not part of the boundary data. Sorry, but one could envisage that this enters as some dynamic. One could imagine that it enters as some additional dynamical variable required to do a better gluing of these vertex amplitudes.
But there would be an extension, you were saying.
But it would be an extension, because if you just take...
Okay.
The way I see it, at least, maybe seeing everything, but the way I'm seeing it at the moment, the straightforward gluing will not carry such tangential degrees of freedom.
It makes sense. What we're understanding at the continuum level is that if you force the SL2R holonomy to be one, you're forcing flatness by definition, in some sense. So you need to allow, because this SL2R holonomy are exactly the gravity waves, if you want. Or some discrete, or, you know, I mean, we are in the continuum, so now we can make the match. So they are the leftovers. So the twist in this twisting, in fact, is very, that's what we discover, is central to have
a... Right. So if you want, I pointed out this at first. There's no twist angle in this description among the boundary data.
Yeah.
Because one is...
Yeah. I was talking about the twist, but also like the mismatch. So now the mismatch is the sign that you should have a non-trivial diffeomorphism when you reglue the faces, right? That's what the mismatch is telling you. That along the face, the two faces are in a different, you know, diffeomorphic frame. Okay. But that goes, that goes kind of beyond the beautiful analysis you did.
But I think it's a nice way of going beyond. In fact, the question on how you glue now these things, it's certainly always, you have the straightforward way, but maybe you are suggesting that one should look for more interesting ways of gluing them. Mm-hmm. I understand. Okay.
Carlo, you look like you want to say something.
I want to
say something. This is to keep me from saying anything.
No, go ahead, Eli.
No, you first.
Well, a couple of short things. One. It's related to previous discussion. Long ago, Lee and I were confused about just at fixed time, it's been network. What is the meaning of taking an node apart subdividing, and what is the valence and so we both went back and forth with it seemed to me that the valence of the node in the current interpretation of loop quantum gravity Hilbert space. It's a well-defined thing. It's attached to a certain set of observables, certain algebra, right. It's not necessarily to view these observables as tetraed or anything, but you have certain fluxes, So in particular, for instance, if you have a large node and you split it, you're just adding some observables, which are the, if you want, the wave function is a function of extra variables, which is...
That's right. You're adding new holonomies that the previous node didn't have.
If you transform a virtual link in the old language into a real link, you're adding a new variable. So you're de facto describing another system, different. So I've been going back and forth whether I like more the model with just for valent vertices and for symplices, or a model with arbitrary number of vertices. And I've been going forth, and I've seen reasons of interest, one and the other. One is simpler, but the other. Recently, in trying to compute things, right now I'm working with Farshid on the black white transition. It just seems horrible to do it with four simplices while doing it in the KKL model. It's just you find a way of doing it, and so I find it that this theory is more flexible, and maybe one can do in other manners. But we're using the KKL. In fact, we're using heavily this result that Simone described for in its asymptotics.
I mean, there is a sense in which, even though, now this goes back also to Bianca's comment, but there is a sense in which, even though the volume simplicity constraints are missing, the general simplex asymptotics is same as the four vertex asymptotics, the four simplex, in the sense that in both cases, Reggio configurations are just a subset of the critical boundary data. Now, in the four simplex case, it is stronger because it's a subset, but it's actually the full set of those boundary data that admit two critical points. And so that is better, actually, because those are the only ones for which the oscillations have a well-defined meaning, because the global phase otherwise is just kind of arbitrary.
But let me remind a bit of history, because the four simplex amplitude was constructed using the geometry of the four simplex. And exactly the volume simplicity constraints were left out because they are automatically satisfied.
Right.
And then
can I say something?
Kamensky, it's not just and Lewandowski came and they generalized the model without having any geometrical consideration, I think, in mind, because it was more on this operator blah level. And indeed, now, we find this volume simplicity is missing. So from the...
I don't know if the volume...
But that's how Benjamin expressed it is. It's in the sense that the reconstruction, full geometric reconstruction, cannot be done. And we know
So let me stop you there. That's wrong. Full geometric reconstruction is possible. It's just that the geometries that appear are more general than Reggio.
Yeah, so they are not Reggio, but we know that the action works for Reggio.
But I don't know about that. Maybe there are. I mean, what we've been discussing with Laurent was maybe we can find the dynamics with shape mismatch.
Yeah, no, I'm not denying that, but I do say they work with Reggie.
Regia is not the only possible way of discretizing GR.
I agree with that, but again, nobody tells me what the dynamics is. And so
that's fine, that's fine, that's right.
Degrees
that's right.
of freedom to Regia.
Yeah, yeah, that's right,
I mean,
that's right.
Mostly you're right. The degrees of freedom in addition to Regia.
No, no, you're right, you're right. It's an interesting question. I think Lee also has a question.
Well, I was really going to come in and go in the direction that you suggested when you were kind enough to quote me before. But let me give the very quickly the full sentiment. My full sentiment, first of all, I admire very much your mastery of the piles of dihedral angles. And there's certainly a lot of beautiful math and beautiful physics there. But maybe we should all take a look at Roger's original papers on spin networks, because the whole point with it, every time you see a cosine in the geometry of space or a sine, Roger said, that's really a limit of a large number of simple spinner processes which all have either ones or minus ones or zeros attached to them and nothing else. In other words, Roger was telling us that when we decompose in terms of spin networks, we see things which are simpler and simpler. And the cosines and the sines and the various geometries and trigonometries arise as limits of large numbers of things piling onto each other. And the really simple thing, now I know you're looking at a large J limit, so this is consistent. If you look in the J equals 1/2 limit, you should just have ones and minus ones and zeros everywhere, according to Roger. And that's the theory of nature that Roger started us on the road to.
That's great. I mean, I would be very happy to do that. And maybe I should also say that the fact that one gets these asymptotics in terms of the Regia action does not mean that this is necessarily the way to go. It's just that it's suggestive of something we can understand. If you have a model in which we just take spins 1/2 and we can describe some interesting physics out of this, and that is the case, for instance, for the black hole entropy, then I think the model will be taken seriously. And in fact, people have taken it seriously for the black hole entropy explanation. Sure. Now, for more than that, we don't have so much. But of course, if we had something, for sure. I mean, they don't even need to be, obstructing each other, these two results. Large spin and still interesting dynamics at small spins.
The style that you're talking about, everything has large J behind it, and Roger wouldn't be bothered with large J with formulas from trigonometry and geometry, because that was his vision. The large J of all these classical things emerge. But the new revolutionary quantum space-time quantum gravity physics was supposed to be simple and down in small J. And I think that's consistent with what everybody's doing. It's just a different direction to look.
Right, yes, yes.
Lee, I think you're pointing in the right direction, and this is particularly interesting for phenomenology and black holes and cosmology, because as you were pointing out, if you want to go in the deep quantum regime, you need small spins. So when we implement the models for bouncing black holes and for that regime, and this is a very interesting possibility for numerics, because at the beginning with numerics we were fighting to go to very high spin, and then at a certain point we realized we don't have to, we can just work with the small spins, because this is the situation we want to describe. So I think there is a possibility that is open by the numerics here. And regarding this, the needs to look at small spins, I think there is I would like to recall a nice paper by Mushin, and I think it was maybe with Minji, in which they were exactly studying the distribution of spins when you are close to a singularity, and showing that it's picked not exactly around 1/2, but rather around 1, spin equal to 1. So there is a nice convergence and a path to follow.
I mean, I'm very happy with all of this. The only fact that I think we should always keep in mind is that these asymptotic formulas are valid at spins of order 10, maybe 100, okay? So we're talking about, I don't know, 10 to the minus 30 meters, so in which these formulas already are valid. So to some extent, we are deep in the quantum gravity regime, and we already see a behavior like this emerging. It might be a red herring. It might be that there's a better physics to extract from really just one half. I'm very happy with that. I'm just saying, let's not forget, we are not talking about, you know, avocado number for the spins. We're really talking about spins 50 or so for these formulas. So
you're all right. I mean, it's, of course, I mean, Lee and Francesca are looking at how to do with quantum gravity, but so you're totally right. In fact, we expect that proper quantum gravity physics will come at low spin. The kind of things that Bianca and Simone and Barrett and so many people and Mushin have been, it's yeah, that's fine. But given a quantum gravity formulation, is there some way? Maybe that's not the right way. In fact, Mushin has an argument that's not the right way. Is it a way to see that in some limit you get classical GR? That's the overall question about. Just one thing, Mushin asked Simone at some point, do you like the vector geometries? I hated them at the beginning because I couldn't understand them. I love them now. One of the reasons is the result by Francesca and Francesco Gozzini in quantum cosmology. I mean, the numerics, it's fantastic, it seems, what it suggests. And if you try to understand the numerics in terms of the asymptotic analysis, I think what is going on is that sort of the cosmological transition that they are studying, it's really dominated by vector geometries. In any case, it must not be dominated by semi-classical solutions of Einstein equations, because you're trying to compute what happens away from where you get to resolve the singularity. So you do want the amplitude to have some sort of meaning away from the standard semi-classical kinematics of general relativity. And vector geometry seem to do in the numerical calculation of Francesco, they seem to play that role. Which is, there's something about those, the Euclidean Lorenzo geometry. This is very vague, but the question, machine question, do you like vector geometry, is even more vague. So there's a sense in which the Euclidean vector geometry are like the Euclidean part of the path integral. And the Euclidean part of the path integral is what, you know, according to Hawking, dominates the whatever happens near the Big Bang. So it might be a way to actually be exploring that part of quantum gravity.
Simone, do you have a sense about how vector geometries are necessary when you have a tunneling process in quantum gravity?
No, I'm sorry. All I have is a sense of why Lorentzian vector geometries don't exist. In this analysis that we did with Pietro, you can see it very clearly from the equations of motion that there's no Lorentzian vector geometry. It's very manifest why they don't exist. But no, I don't have a sense. But as I said, the one careful thing that one has to... There's one thing that one has to be careful if using vector geometries is that if you're only interested in the norm of the amplitude, that's fine. But if you're interested in oscillatory behavior associated with the complex phase of the amplitude in the vector geometry sector, you have to be very careful because it's very ambiguous. It depends on phase conventions. It depends on the way the way the coherent amplitude is defined. There are inequivalent ways of defining it, which they change the phase. And it also depends on the orientation of the normals, not just on the geometric information, namely the angles and the areas. So provided you're just using the Hessian, there's no source of ambiguity, but if you're using also the complex phase for your physical applications, then you have to be to keep this in mind.
Okay, so we're hitting, well, we passed 1.5 hours, so unless there are other urgent questions.
Make one short comment, just one.
Okay.
It's very fast. I mean, this result of Simone and company
Pietro.
It's just Pietro. I was afraid of letting out somebody else. Just Simone and Pietro. It's being used, not the action, but the counting of the degrees of freedom by Farshid, who is writing his PhD thesis, and explicitly to compute the black to white whole transition. And what is coming out, it seems, I mean, up to check, it seems to that the apparent bubble divergence that you expect there in the transition is killed, is suppressed, at least what seemed to be the dominant part, by just going through this analysis of where is the amplitude to suppress, which would be a nice way of using that.
That's good. Yeah, cool. That's good to hear. Thank you, everyone.
All right.
And good night from me here.
Yeah. Thanks again.